Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Thursday, November 10th, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Christina Gomez will tell us about UAS's One Campus, One Book selection titled Mixed, Multiracial College Students Tell Their Life Stories. Kaya Henriksen of the Juno Douglas City Museum will tell us about Walter Soboloff Day activities. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council will highlight the upcoming Wild and Scenic Film Festival. We'll meet the Canvas's new ceramics teacher, and Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts Up. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. Currently 48 degrees at the Juno Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some national Native organizations are expressing a need to work together with the newly elected U.S. president. The American Indian Higher Education Consortium, which represents the 37 U.S. tribal colleges and universities, released a statement Wednesday calling for peace, unity, and success for President-elect Donald Trump. Tribal college leaders are preparing to work with the new administration and Congress on ensuring higher educational opportunities for Native people. A former Navajo Nation leader says he welcomes the incoming Trump administration as an opportunity for economic growth. Ben Shelley says Trump's stance on fossil fuels and other resources is good for realizing the Navajo Nation's potential.
We have a lot of resource, oil and gas and also coal. And that's something that can create jobs and so on and market those. And those are the things that I think Trump stands for.
Days before the election, Shelley greeted Donald Trump Jr. during a campaign stop on the Navajo Nation and presented him with a necklace. The current leaders of the tribe had officially endorsed Hillary Clinton for president. On Wednesday, Navajo Nation Vice President Jonathan Nez took to social media to congratulate Trump, saying voters have chosen a new president and expressed a time for unity and moving forward. A federal program which aims to return land on reservations to tribal control is expected to run short, but at least one Oregon tribe says it's unlikely to feel an impact. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Under a 2009 settlement, the Obama administration is spending $1.6 billion to buy parcels of land with multiple owners and transfer them to tribal governments. But an Interior Department report says when the money runs out in 2022, over 4 million eligible acres will remain. Chuck Sams, a spokesman for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. He says they were the prototype for breaking up communal lands for individual ownership back in 1885.
The Slater Act, which predated the Dawes Act by 2 years, was used as an example of how to break up reservations into checkerboard ownership. So we were one of the first tribes to negotiate and come into agreement with the Department of Interior on the land buyback program, and it's been actually very successful here on the Umatilla Indian Reservation.
Sam says 87% of tribal members have positively responded, giving 10,000 acres of land back to tribal stewardship. Backers hope Congress will make the program permanent, which would enable more land purchases. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
184 tribal members have graduated from the Cheyenne River Youth Project Center of Life Teen Internship Program in South Dakota. Jim Kent has more.
Over the past 3 years, the Cheyenne River Youth Project has provided instruction, mentorship, workshops, certifications, real-life job experience, and wages to teenage tribal members. Julie Garrow is the project's executive director. She says the real goal is for young people to gain valuable skills that will serve them well all their lives, as well as having a lasting impact on the Cheyenne River Reservation's economy.
They receive, upon completion of their internship curriculum, a stipend, which some of the kids, you know, gone on to buy lawnmowers or bought musical equipment or done other things that maybe help them grow. Some of them will also help the family. Some of them will buy their school clothes. Some of them will spend it on whatever they want to spend it on, but it's their money, so that's fine. What I love are the kids who are, you know, they're taking it so that they're kind of using the money and it takes them a little bit further. I like that.
For example, notes Garrow, the teen who used his stipend to buy a lawnmower and started providing local lawn care services. 352 Cheyenne River Sioux teens have graduated the internship program since its inception in 2014. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Northern Arizona University, a university committed to serving Native American students, offering opportunity in every direction, in Flagstaff, at community colleges around the state, and online. Learn more at nau.edu. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You are listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Thursday, November 10th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, and I've been joined in the studio now by Jonas Lamb from UAS and also Christina Gomez. She is one of the co-editors of Mixed Multiracial College Students Tell Their Life. It's this year's UAS One Campus One book selection. Welcome both of you to the studio.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. Jonas, if our listeners don't know what One Campus, One Book is yet, can you tell us about that?
Sure. In a nutshell, One Campus, One Book is the common reading program at UAS, and that's sort of a strategy used at universities across the country in that we provide copies of a book for all incoming freshmen or for a cohort, a group of students, and provide opportunities for them to talk about that book in the class, outside of the class, with their families, sort of a common starting point for new students so that they have something that they can talk to each other about. We try to look for a book that students can identify with, and we were pretty excited about finding a collection this year that's really told from the student perspective. It's something that we hadn't found before, so we were excited.
Yeah, Christina, will you tell us more about the book?
Sure. The book is a collection of students who we worked with when we were at Dartmouth College who identify as being mixed. So they're individuals who have different racial backgrounds given their parentage. Usually when people talk about mixed in the United States, we tend to think of white and black. What's different about this book is it's all sorts of variations. So we have students who are Japanese and Bangladeshi, who are Native and white, who are Chinese and white, who are Mexican and African-American. So it's a variety of individuals who really see their identity in so many different ways, and also many of them are also international and have an international experience.
Okay. Maybe in a minute, do you happen to have a selection you could share with our listeners from the book?
Yeah.
Is this program working? As far as I can tell, it is, Jonas, from what I've seen at the university. From your perspective, this One Campus, One Book, is it working?
That's a really good question, Scott. I think that every year when I'm asked this, I have to think about the conversations that I see students having with the guest speakers that we bring in. And it's always a really condensed, intense couple of days on campus interacting with an author of a book that they've had the chance to experience and talk about in class. Last year, there was an incredible reception for our guest author, Ernestine Hayes, in which these students had these really personal reactions to that Alaska Native memoir, where it was sort of an opportunity for them to share their own experience, maybe an outlet that they wouldn't have otherwise had. To follow up on that, whether or not it's increasing retention, building community on our campus and getting the students to stay, anecdotally, I would love to say yes, but I think assessment is definitely a piece that's lacking in our program. But I see smiling faces. I see faculty that are always eager to use the book in their classes and to invite our guest speakers to the class. So it's well supported on campus. But the verdict's still out.
Well, I would give it a big thumbs up. So
thanks,
keep
Scott.
Up the great work. Christina, did you have a selection you'd like
sure.
to share?
Sure. Just for our audience, so the book is a series of 12 different narratives where we worked with students, and we split up the narratives in three different parts. One part that's rather thematic of people who identify as and often are thinking about who am I in terms of their question. Part two is about feeling in between neither of one group or the other. And then the third part really are students who see themselves in an entirely different way, and we call that part a different perspective. So I'm going to read from Allison Bates' story, which is titled A Sort of Hybrid. And she talks about her identity, and I'll read the first opening page for the readers. I think it's really beautiful. So this is Allison Bates' story, A Sort of Hybrid. I always felt like an outsider. I have never once felt like I belonged to something or someone. Thinking of this has brought tears to my eyes many times. At every stage in my life so far, I've had to deal with my race and what it means to be both black and white. I have faced one test after another, and each time I have looked to my siblings and within myself to get through. We never talked about race in my family. When I look back now, that seems strange, because race played such a powerful role in our everyday lives. I didn't even understand what race was until I was older. As I grew up, this inability to locate what I was experiencing led to a lot of confusion about my identity. In the neighborhoods where I lived, I could see white people and black people and brown people and yellow people, but I never placed my parents in those categories. I never saw my parents' race until my mother wasn't my white mom, my father wasn't my black dad, until I was probably 13 or 14. I remember emerging moments of awareness. Oh yeah, my mom's white, and that's weird, I recall wondering as a five-year-old, while waiting at the bus stop in Los Angeles with my sister and mom, when people looked at us funny. I knew they were talking about us when there were questions from other kids. What are you, adopted? Is that your mom? Why don't you look like her? Over time, I became embarrassed and found that it was easier to say I was adopted than to explain to my fifth grade classmates why my mom was in fact my real mom.
Thank you for sharing. As you put this together, this collection, what surprised you most, or what did you learn from it?
Although this book is about mixed race individuals, I think one of the illuminating things is that in forming their identity and understanding themselves, it's really the questions that we all have. Who am I? Where do I belong? Am I loved? And so in that sense, I think it's really beautiful, because I think we all search for that. Because these individuals are mixed, these questions are so much more present. But they share what we see in many of our college students as we begin to grow.
Okay. So you're going to be giving the Evening at Egan talk tomorrow at UAS Friday on Veterans Day, 7 p.m. Is that right, Jonas?
That's correct.
Christina, what do you plan on doing as part of your talk?
Sure. So I hope to open up the talk and really talk about what's going on in the United States with regards to the number of mixed race people. This concept of mixed race, although it has always been present, all of us to some extent are mixed, race is a social construction, is relatively new, because now the way the census codes us, right, these racial identifiers, allows for us to identify as mixed. What many people don't realize is that it wasn't until the 2000 census that we were allowed to choose more than one. Prior to that, when we filled out census forms, we had to choose one race. And although many of us know we're from mixed heritage, we couldn't actually list that. And for a variety of reasons, that's changed. So we're now beginning to get real data as to who's identifying mixed, how are they mixed, and also other correlates like income, education, where they live, et cetera. So I'm going to be talking about what's happening in the U.S. with regard to that. Secondly, I'm going to talk about what the experience of people who are mixed has been, and to share some of these stories with the audience, because I think it really begins to highlight how much race is such a big part of our lives in the United States, at the same time, how quickly it's changing.
Okay. This sounds really interesting. This is tomorrow, Friday at 7 o'clock. If one of our listeners who's not a student wanted to get a copy of this book, Jonas, where should they go?
There are copies available in the local library system that they can get their hands on, and I would always recommend Hearthside Books. Books are out there.
We could do one community, one book.
You know, yeah. Right? Lansing does that. Chicago does that.
I'll be happy to come back.
It's great to have you here. So again, that's 7 p.m. tomorrow as part of the Evening at Evening lecture series. We've been hearing from Christina Gomez. She's from the Art Institute of Chicago, among other places, and the book that she's helped edit is Mixed, Multiracial College Students Tell Their Life. Sounds very interesting. Is there anything else either of you would like to add?
I don't think so, Scott. It's always a pleasure to be on the show, and I love what you do to promote events in this community.
Well, thank you both, and thanks for coming to Juneau.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Thursday, November 10th, 2016. It's about 20 minutes past the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host, and I have been joined in the studio now by individuals from the Juno Douglas City Museum, Jane Lindsay, and also Kaya Henriksen. Welcome to the show, you two, from the museum.
Thank you.
And Mr. Ross Soboloff, the son of Dr. Walter Soboloff himself. Sir, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
An honor to have you here.
Thank you.
Okay, so the actual Dr. Walter Soboloff Day is on Monday, is that right?
That's correct, the November 14th.
But the museum is taking it further.
Yes, so we decided to honor Dr. Soboloff all during the month of November this year by asking people to write cards or notes of encouragement and thanks to people in their lives. And the museum is providing free note cards and U.S. postage. And we have a small business card sized insert that says that this note is being sent in honor of Dr. Soboloff. And anyone who stops by the museum can pick those up. Or if there's a group in town that would like the cards or the inserts to use with a classroom or a group, they can contact me at the museum at 586-3572, and I can send them on. And so far, we've had 179 participants just since we've started.
That is excellent. I don't know that I knew that he was such a prolific note and thank you writer. I mean, we know all the tremendous things that he's done for the state and civil rights. Ross, do you remember seeing your dad write notes? Where did he write? What? Where would he go? Describe that for us, if you will.
Well, he lived on his own until the very end. He didn't want to be in assisted living or anything because he's very independent. And normally part of his day was going to the post office or having someone go to the post office for him. And he was usually sitting at home, usually had a pen and cards or something within easy reach. So he did it all the time, probably every day. And he told me many years ago when I was just starting out in life that helping someone is very difficult. Not difficult, but it's not easy. And he said it's hard to do something to help a person that doesn't, you have to be sure you want to protect their dignity and you don't want to do something that might build a dependency or get in the way of a person, you know, being self-reliant. And so all of that sounds kind of lofty. He really, by writing note cards and words of encouragement, found a simple way that he could help people. And you know, I still hear about it at least once a week. I got a card from your dad, and I still own it, and it meant so much to me at the time. So,
okay, Jane, this sounds like a really great interactive way to honor this great person. I think Kaya spoke to it a little bit, but what inspired this on your end?
Yeah, good question. So, pardon me. So Ross and I are married, and I work at the City Museum. And through my time being with Ross, I got to know Walter as well. Very special. But also traveling around with my husband, it is like that. People constantly come up to him, especially in Alaska. Sometimes he's like, oh, it's so nice to be where nobody knows me. But in Alaska, they all know his father. He looks a lot like his father. And so I listen to what folks remember. And it really struck me about 3 years ago, as Walter Soboloff Day was being signed into legislation, that, you know, what could I do? What could we do? What's a simple thing? What's so meaningful? And to me, that was it. So we've actually been doing this for 3 years. And this is the first year that we've said, look, let's just do it all month. And we've also very easily got some sponsors that wanted to sponsor free winter admission. But yeah, it I remember cards that were sent to me or my children. And when we would drive him around, he didn't drive for, I don't know, what, 10, 15 years before
About
he passed?
15 years.
Yeah. That was, I hear, very difficult to take the license away. It was a delicate thing. But so we would pick him up, take him places like everyone else in the family. And we were always checking the mail, and we were always taking things to the mail. And it wasn't bills. It was just these cards coming back. So
it's such a nice thing these days when you actually see handwriting on a letter in your mailbox, right? Kaya, tell us what this looks like for a person that wants to go into the library. What days can they come in? What's it going to look like once they get inside? How can they participate?
Well, the museum is open Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., and we're located at the corner of 4th and Main Street. So, and we do have free admission all winter, so people can just walk in the door. The cards are right there at the front desk, and we often have a volunteer at the front desk or a staff member who can assist the person who comes in if they need help or if they have questions. We have some material about Dr. Sobolev available if people would like to learn more about him, but it's pretty simple. They can also call if, as I said, we've had a few teachers who've expressed interest in doing this with their classes and other groups, and I've put together packets of the inserts for them or cards to send out so that they can use them off-site. And that's another option for people who can't make it to the museum.
Okay. Ross, can you tell us something about your dad that maybe we don't know? What was he like at home, or what was he like at the park? Something that we haven't read in books.
I would say he was always reading. He was always learning. I think just about every waking hour that he had, he was trying to learn something new. And he told me one time that he woke up one day in Tanaki and he said, you know, I'm gonna think a Tlingit thought today, because, you know, he really in his life kind of pulled all different things together to make his life. But he saw a bird sitting on a limb in the early spring, and he said, I can't speak Tlingit, but he said in Tlingit that the little bird was singing a song to encourage the leaves to open up in the springtime. I'm sure it sounded way better in Tlingit, but that he tried to put all of these different parts of his life together, but he was always, you know, really looking for knowledge, really looking for, shall I say, wisdom, always looking for ways to uplift people. Well, you asked for something people don't know, and they probably know that one, but that's what I got today.
How about, may I ask you the same question, Jane?
Well, you know, having dinner with him, especially towards the end, he didn't hear very well. So we would often just have a very quiet dinner. And I have to agree with Ross. He'd always surprise us by, you could tell he had been thinking and the way he was putting things together. His humor, of course, is pretty well known. I have a little story quickly about just a note that's always touched me. Ross ran as an independent for the Sea Alaska Corporation Board several years ago, and he was not successful. And, you know, Ross knew that it was going to be tough because of the way elections are run and, you know, getting to all the shareholders and all that. It was quite costly, lots of time. So, you know, Ross seemed okay with it. And lo and behold, in the mail, we got, Ross got it and I got to look at it. He got a card from his father, who was a Mason, a devoted, devout Mason for years. And he had torn out a little piece of the newsletter, and it was all of the ways Abraham Lincoln had failed. And at the top, it said, "Dear son." And then at the bottom, it said, "Love, Dad." And I just thought that was the most precious thing. And we had it up on the refrigerator for a while because nobody else was really saying much. And of course, you know, we knew it was a tough battle. Ross was going to take it on, you know, and he was good good-spirited about it, and just getting that from Walter, I just thought was so touching, to his son. And that is one thing I always noticed when we had dinner together, was how tender he was with his son, and also attentive and respectful. Very different than sometimes at our dinner table with my kids, but there was just this real respect and love. He really cherished his children and really was attentive to them in ways that were very special.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing both of those stories. You can participate in Walter Soboloff Day, Dr. Walter Soboloff Day, by going to the Juno Douglas Library and writing notes that encourage recognition, kindness, tolerance. This just sounds such a great participatory way to honor this great man. And will you remind us one more time when people can do this, Kaya?
Yes, it's Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the City Museum at 4th and Main Streets.
And so once people write the note, do they have to go get a stamp and put it on the note? Do you do that for them? How's that going to work?
We have free stamps available, so people can take them with them if they want, or if they want to write the letter there and leave it, we can put it in the mail.
Okay. Sounds great. Is there anything else that any of you would like to add?
No, just thanks for having us on and all the great work that you do here at K2.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.
Oh, anytime. Thank you.
This is Bird Note. Kelly Bryan spends his days in Big Bend National Park banding hummingbirds to better understand their behavior. Bird Note contributor Alex Chadwick reports.
I'm watching Kelly work with the birds, tiny, colorful, delicate, held carefully in his blunt, working hands. He's banded more than 14,000 hummingbirds, he says, and never injured one. He's about to release this one.
I'm gonna hold it up to your ear. Sounds like a little motor in overdrive, doesn't it?
The bands are very small, uniquely numbered strips of aluminum, and one goes around one small bird leg above the foot.
Human's heart beats about 70, 80 beats a minute. Even at rest, the hummingbird's heart is beating 700 to 800 beats a minute. And this little bird's probably at about 1,200 beats a minute.
Kelly studies hummingbirds by banding legs and keeping data on each one.
Okay, here comes the first bird. I'll reach into this bag. And the thing about hummingbirds is you've got to maintain control over them.
It can be unnerving to see a captured hummingbird, vulnerable and wide-eyed. Kelly has his fingers over the shoulders to stop the wings beating. He slips a tiny numbered band on a leg, measures length of feathers and the bill, and then weighs the bird.
You can put about 8 of these birds in an envelope and mail them.
8 to an ounce.
He's done, and he goes bye-bye.
For Bird Note, this is Alex Chadwick in Big Bend National Park. Funding for Bird Note series from Big Bend came from Dee Dee and Rusty Rose.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Thursday, November 10th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, is about 3 minutes past the bottom of the hour. And joining me now in the studio is Meredith Trainer. She's the executive director of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so the Wild and Scenic Film Festival. How many years have you all been doing this now?
This is actually our first year, and we're super excited to be hosting it. Wild and Scenic is an incredible Film Fest focused on building environmental activism, and it was previously held by other nonprofits in the region. And when we had the opportunity to come and to become a host through our Waterkeeper program, we just jumped on it.
Okay. How many films are involved? Where and when is it?
It's tonight. So if folks are looking for something to do on a great rainy evening in Juneau, we are the place to be at the Rockwell Ballroom. It's tonight, and the Film Fest starts at 7. With doors opening at 6:30. The Film Fest is focused on celebrating our waterways and the beautiful places on the earth where we feel most engaged and where people are most able to make a difference. So it's a real feel-good Film Fest in a week that for some folks might have been a tough one.
And proceeds go to SEAC?
Yes, it's a fundraiser to help support the organization. I'm a new executive director with SEAC this year, and we're super excited to be growing and expanding our programs, and this is going to help us get there.
In case some of our listeners don't know what SEAC is, can you tell us a little bit about it?
I'd love to. So SEAC is the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. We started 46 years ago to help protect the Tongass National Forest from an extensive harvest of old growth trees, some of our most beautiful, most precious resources here. And today we've added programs focusing on water conservation and protecting our clean water for salmon, for the people of Southeast Alaska, and sort of all throughout the region.
Okay. And may I ask, besides this film festival tonight, what's on your radar right now? What's SEAC looking at?
We're doing all kinds of good work. You know, we've worked on the Tongass National Forest has a new land management plan that's in the process of being approved, and we've worked on that recently. We're looking now to some new issues related to forest management in the region, especially in the context of a new administration federally. And we're also looking to do some clean water work, you know, making sure that the waterways where we fish and where we spend our time and take our children out on boats are protected, and that those fish that we're eating aren't picking up, you know, pollutants from some of the regional but especially transboundary mines. So we're working on a lot of those issues. And the water side of our work through the Inside Passage Waterkeeper Program will be what we're emphasizing tonight.
About how many folks work up at SEAC?
We're tiny. We're just we're growing. Right now, we added a new staff member this week, and we'll be adding another in January. So that'll bring us up to a whopping 7 staff members, with only one person devoted full-time to our water work. But we're really hoping to build that out, and this film fest and the support of our sponsors is really going to help make that happen.
If somebody wanted to help support SEAC, how can they do that? Where can they find you online, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, they could go to SEAC.org. SEAC's kind of a funny sound, so that's SEACC.org. And if you wanted to, you could do SEAC.org/donate. And that's a good place to make a donation, but you can just find it by going to the site itself. If they're in town tonight, they should definitely come to the Film Fest. The tickets are $15 for adults, $10 with a student ID, and $5 for kids 12 and under. For this particular film fest, anyone under 21 needs to be accompanied by a parent or guardian simply because it's being held at a bar at the Rockwell.
Okay. And is it downstairs or upstairs?
It's upstairs in the ballroom.
Okay.
Yep.
And about how long will it last?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think I've edited it up just yet today. Probably about 2 hours, so figuring about 7 to 9. We're featuring 2 local films, which is we're particularly proud of. Our film that SEAC helped produce called Water is Life, which is about the Stickeen River along both sides of the Alaskan-Canadian border. And then Transboundary, produced by our partner Salmon Beyond Borders, which talks about the way that our fisheries could be compromised by some of those transboundary mines we were talking about.
Okay. That's the Wild and Scenic Film Festival benefiting the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council tonight. Doors open at 6:30. Cameras roll at 7. Film rolls at 7. Digital projectors roll at 7, probably.
Yeah, the DVD. The DVD
spins.
Circles at 7.
It starts spinning. And that's at the Rockwell Ballroom downtown. Meredith Trainer, is there anything else you'd like to add?
The only other thing I should mention is we have some great local donors and supporters who have provided some awesome raffle prizes. So we've got, there's too many probably to list right now, but come on over. We're going to have ice cream from Copa. We've got beer from Alaskan Brewing. It's going to be a party. Everyone needs to relax, and it's the beginning of a 3-day weekend. Let's hang out.
Meredith, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Kentucky's my home, where the wild deer and the black bear so lately did roam. By the clear rushing waterfall, the wildflowers dream, and through every dark valley there runs a clear stream. Now there's scenes of destruction on sweet tongue.
cigarette break lasts 10 to 15 minutes. The average high school basketball game lasts 32 minutes. Many high school campuses have tobacco-free policies to protect people from secondhand smoke. Don't chance missing your team's winning shot by stepping off campus to smoke. Quit tobacco today. For support, call Alaska's Tobacco Quitline at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. Brought to you by the Partnership for a Tobacco-Free Southeast and CERT.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Thursday, November 10th. It's about 15 minutes until the top of the hour. And joining me in the studio now is Mercedes Munoz. She's the artistic coordinator over at the Canvas. And Alex Botello, he is the new ceramics teacher at the Canvas. Welcome to the show, you two.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks, Scott.
Anytime. Should we start with you, Mercedes? What's going on at the Canvas?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a lot of exciting classes coming up this fall at the Canvas, a couple of which are starting this week. So one will be this Saturday, a beginning jewelry workshop, and that's for all skill levels. If you've never touched any jewelry making materials before, this is a great opportunity. That's being taught by Rowan Law, and it's a one-day class, so 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. all day long, and then you walk away with some handmade jewelry, which is really cool. So that's one thing we have coming up this week. We also have a class by our new ceramic studio manager, Alex Botello, and that's going to be cups and mugs. And previous wheel throwing experience recommended for that, but that'll be a fun special topics class. We also have a few more longer classes this fall. We'll have another jewelry class with Angie Lawler. It's an intro to metalsmithing. We have some more classes coming up by our resident artist, Emma Davidson. She's here with us just till the beginning of December, so few more opportunities to take a class with her. And then, as always, we have a lot of holiday-themed classes. So keep an eye out. In December, we have workshops for making cards, for making ornaments, ceramic hand building, gingerbread house decorating, which is always a fun one, and mixed metal ornaments. So we have tons of holiday workshops that are great for family. If you want to take a class with a friend, just a fun one or two night thing, or bring your family to it, all ages are welcome for all of those classes.
Great. And I was going to ask you more about that. I imagine it changes from class to class, you know, like Alex's class is going to require, you know, it'd be nice if he had some previous experience on the wheel. Who benefits most from these classes? Or, you know, age groups? How would you describe the people that enjoy them most or get the most out of them?
So for all of our classes, we really try to give a clear picture of the target audience. So we will specify if all ages are welcome. With our holiday classes, we do that in particular. You know, we'll have a couple friends taking it just for something fun to do, or we'll have a mother and daughter or family. So for those holiday workshops, it really varies, and we get a wide variety of people in those, which can be really fun. And then for our longer classes or other workshops that we just have throughout the year, most of them we really try to target beginner level, so anybody could take them. And like Alex's Cups and Mugs class, we'll just specify if previous experience would be helpful. But generally, all our classes are perfect for beginners, so that's what we strive for. We want to bring in people who maybe normally wouldn't take a class.
Okay. Alex, tell us about yourself.
I just started this position about 3 weeks ago as a ceramic studio manager, but my involvement in ceramics in Juneau, I think, started my freshman year at UAS, which was almost seven years ago. So I took a class out there with Jeremy Kane, and he was kind of the start of my love for ceramics, and really has motivated me to stay in it. And the position at the Canvas sort of arose and was offered to me. And I thought it was such a perfect opportunity to kind of stay involved in the community in Juneau, and also just stay in clay, which I think is such a fun medium for people from just so many different backgrounds to have like a different, I don't know, just approach to art. So I've been really enjoying it so far. There hadn't been a manager in the studio, I think, for a couple months since I was there, or started working. So I've really just been trying to make the studio a little bit my own, trying to have a flow that I think makes sense and makes it really welcoming and easy to work in for everyone that's coming in. And it already, I feel like I'm starting to see results. There's people that are coming in, starting to call them regulars, I guess, which is really exciting to make it the community space that I really hope and I'm striving to make it.
Great. How would you describe both your artistic style and your teaching style?
Well, I guess my artistic style in ceramics is, I guess the term is often used wabi-sabi, so it's a kind of a loose form. I really like kind of these wonky shapes, and I'm really used to doing kind of high-fire ceramics, so this is a higher temperature. There's a little bit more unpredictability in glazes, so there's a lot of sort of runny fluid motion, I guess, is what it normally looks like. And the canvas, we have electric fire, so it's a lower fire, but we still have some really, really great selections. So I'm kind of curious to see how I'm going to adapt to that. But my teaching style, really my emphasis is just sort of to bring out the process. And I think like art as a therapy and really just kind of as something to do is a really great way to work with your hands and so, you know, it's not so much about what the end product is, so much as you're enjoying the process and kind of learning from it and bringing that kind of quality out. So, I'm really excited for the first couple classes that I'll be teaching over there.
Okay.
And we'll also have a couple of beginning classes for Alex coming up in January, too. We're getting that on the schedule right now, and we will be at Public Market with a full advertised schedule of classes for January and February. So keep an eye out because we'll definitely have some beginning wheel throwing for those of you who haven't done any pottery before but want to give it a try.
And maybe both of this question goes out to both of you. For somebody who's never been to the canvas, describe what your mission is there and what the atmosphere is like, because every time I walk by, it looks like people are having so much fun. Describe that for our listeners, if you will.
Okay, so we serve individuals with developmental disabilities. During the day, we have classes that are solely for them, but one thing that we've brought out recently is an open studio in our drawing room. So we really try to engage the community and bring new people in during those classes as well. And some of our individuals take the evening classes as well. We always try to get them into those. We'll hopefully get a couple of our artists who love ceramics into Alex's classes this coming year. So our focus is really inclusion and making this a space that everybody feels like it's their own. So the community members, the people we serve, everybody feels welcome there and feels like it's their own. And so we want to do that with classes and the ceramic studio, as well as the drawing and painting room and any events that we have.
Yeah, and I think that, it's definitely evident that inclusion is kind of what's going on at the canvas. And it seems to be a really kind of big push that's going through the entire business. Just trying to integrate everyone into the community and having the space to be available to everyone. And so it's been fun seeing a lot of people coming through from every type of background and trying to utilize the space. And it is it's just a really, I think, open and kind of warm place to go if you're trying to kind of get involved in the arts, whatever capacity that might be in. And
Okay. What's the best place to see a list of all these classes, Mercedes?
Oh, that's a good question. So we have all our classes advertised online. We're updating that regularly. And then if you ever stop into the canvas too, we have a printed out schedule with a full, right now we have the full fall schedule. And then in a few weeks here, we'll have the schedule coming out for the following months. So we try to book out as far in advance as we can. So check us out online. canvasarts.org, or come in and grab a flyer.
Great. Mercedes Munoz, she's the artistic coordinator, and Alex Botello, ceramics teacher and studio coordinator.
That'll work. Yeah.
Thank you both for coming on the show, and have a great, great fall.
Thank you so much for having us.
Come back and see us when you have more classes going on too, please.
We will. Yeah.
Listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Thursday, November 10th, about 7 minutes until the top of the hour. With me in the studio now is the one, the only, the executive director of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, Ms. Nancy DeCherney.
Packing an entire week into 7 minutes.
Can we do it?
Okay, well, you've ready? Already covered quite a few really good things, and I will say if there, you should just go to the Arts Council website, which is new. You may have to refresh in order to get it to come up and see the calendar to get all the details. I would say the high notes for this week, 84 Charing Cross Road over at McPheeters Hall with Theater in the Rough, and this weekend only, putting it together, the Stephen Sondheim thing. And I didn't really know what this was about, so I looked it up. And it's an sort of a melange of Sondheim songs, some of my very favorites, like Everybody Should Have a Maid, which I realize is perhaps a little non-PC at this point. But it's just a whole bunch of great songs and wonderful people singing. And there's artwork that you can bid on by all sorts of different artists, like Terry Gardner-Robas and M.K. McNaughton and just Laurie Daniels. So it's a really interesting set. It's happening over at the Jack. I've been able to listen to the rehearsals, and it's just lovely. Don't let this one sneak past you, because you've only got Friday, Saturday, and Sunday to see this.
And is there a preview tonight, maybe?
There's a preview tonight, and I think you can still get tickets to that, too. It's a little wine and cheese type thing. I didn't realize all the things that Stephen Sondheim had written, you know? Like, a lot of cool stuff.
He's won a lot of awards, too.
Yeah. You know, I just, all of a sudden, things started bubbling out, and I go, I remember that movie. I remember that one. You know, so it's being directed by William Conroe. It's got Dan Wayne, Heather Mitchell, Patricia Hull, Jessica Skiba, Derek Grimes, Alicia Fahlberg, Kim Andre, Joan Cahill, and Janice Hurley all in it. I think there's more. But anyway, that's
a
thing
that
to do this weekend is you got the Charing Cross Road and the Sondheim thing. There are a lot of other things, like you mentioned, the Walter Soboloff writing notes, which is a really fun and pleasant thing to do. We have a presentation at 7:30 tonight, or 7 o'clock tonight, about the last hangings in Alaska, in case that's fast. And we do have the film of The Empty Chair, which is over at Gold Town Nickelodeon. So a lot of really, and of course, it's all starting to be all the markets and the bazaars and all that sort of stuff. It's second Saturday market at the airport. We've got a craft and collectibles market or fair at Mendenhall Mall. We have a holiday bazaar at St. Brendan's Episcopal. So it's just, you know, it's that season where you start finding these sorts of things to do. So get out and do some stuff. Did we make it?
Gather in warm places with
yes.
community.
Yes.
It's a great way to spend these dark evenings.
Yes, yes.
And remind us again where people go to find out more about what you just
It's jahc.org, or you could come to ktoo.org. So, and by the way, like I mentioned, our website's under revision, so if you find a link that doesn't work, please let us know so we can get that fixed. It's looking good.
All right. Nancy DeCherney, she is the executive director of the Juno Arts and Humanities Council here with our weekly edition of Arts Up. Nancy, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow, we won't be in the studio, but Jeff has loaded a special honoring Veterans Day. And the forecast for tomorrow calls for showers, highs near 46, east wind 20 to 30 miles per hour. And the forecast for Saturday calls for showers likely before noon, then rain mainly afternoon. Thank you.